is the B storyteller, dub poet, partly raised in Montreal, Montreal, Mont Real, launching my new CD 333. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
A nearly three-decade-old ceasefire has ended in occupied Western Sahara. Morocco's occupied the territory since 1975 in defiance of the United Nations and the international community. Western Sahara is widely considered to be Africa's last colony. Over the weekend, fighting broke out in several areas between the Moroccan military and the Polisario Front, the Sahrawi liberation movement seeking independence. Meanwhile, Morocco's intensified its repression in occupied Western Sahara, raiding the homes of independence activists, cracking down on protests. Moroccan military drones were reportedly spotted in the city of Dakhla. The ceasefire ended Friday after the Moroccan military broke into a no-go buffer zone in southern Western Sahara and exchanged fire with the Polisario Front. For the past 3 weeks, Sahrawi civilian protesters had blocked a Morocco-built road in the area that Sahrawis consider to be illegal. The peaceful blockade backed up traffic for miles and cut off trade between Morocco and Mauritania to the south. The Moroccan military entered the buffer zone on Friday morning to disperse the civilians who were evacuated to safety by the Polisario Front. Morocco took military action just hours after U.S. Major General Andrew Rolling met in Morocco with the commander of the Royal Moroccan Armed Forces Southern Zone, which includes occupied Western Sahara. At the United Nations, a spokesperson for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned against further violations of the ceasefire.
The Secretary General remains committed to doing his utmost to avoid the collapse of the ceasefire that has been in place since 6 September 1991. And he is determined to do everything possible to remove all obstacles to the resumption of the political process.
The Polisario Front says hundreds of Sahrawi volunteers have signed up and left for the front over the weekend from Sahrawi refugee camps in Algeria. Sidi Omar, the Polisario Front's representative to the United Nations, said, quote, "For us, it is an open war," unquote. In the streets of El Aaiún, the largest city in Western Sahara, Sahrawis protesters took to the streets in a nighttime demonstration for independence. Sahrawis also demonstrated over the weekend in other cities, including occupied Dashla. Protests in solidarity with Sahrawi independence also occurred over the weekend in Spain and in New Zealand, where activists with Extinction Rebellion and other groups protested at a fertilizer company which buys phosphate from occupied Western Sahara. In a moment, we'll speak to Professor Jacob Munde at Colgate University about the end of the ceasefire. But first, let's take a look at the roots of the crisis. In 2016, Democracy Now! Broke the media blockade imposed by Morocco and reported from inside occupied Western Sahara. We were the first international news team to report from the occupied territory in years. This is an excerpt from our documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. Western Sahara, where peaceful protesters led by women are beaten in the streets. Thousands have been tortured, imprisoned, killed, and disappeared while resisting the Moroccan occupation.
He jabbed right at my eye with his baton. I was yelling at him, "Hey, you Moroccan, you pulled out my eye."
Where natural resources are plundered, from phosphates to fish.
I say that our damnation comes from the natural resources we have here. If it wasn't for these natural resources, Morocco would never have invaded Western Sahara.
Where a massive wall divides a people, the Sahrawi, the native population, denied a vote for self-determination.
If we don't speak out, especially us as victims who have suffered all of this, if we don't speak out and defend our cause, this problem will remain.
Western Sahara, the center of a 4-decades-long struggle for independence from Morocco, its neighbor to the north. Morocco has occupied the territory since 1975 in defiance of the United Nations and the international community. The story of Western Sahara is one of colonialism, plunder, and resistance. It's also a story rarely told in the international media. And it's here in Western Sahara where the scholar Noam Chomsky says the Arab Spring first began in late 2010, before the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt.
And the Moroccan forces came in, destroyed the tent cities, a lot of killed, wounded, and so on, and then it spread.
But the struggle in Western Sahara dates back much longer. For nearly a century, Western Sahara was colonized by Spain. But the Spanish occupation ended in 1975, setting off a regional fight. On October 31, 1975, both Morocco from the north and Mauritania from the south invaded Western Sahara as Spain withdrew. Days after Moroccan troops invaded, King Hassan II ordered hundreds of thousands of Moroccan citizens to enter Western Sahara in what became known as the Green March. Mauritania would withdraw less than 4 years later, but Morocco has remained to this day. Just days after the Moroccan invasion, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger privately told President Gerald Ford he hoped for a, quote, rigged UN vote at the Security Council to confirm Morocco's claim over Western Sahara. About half of the Sahrawi population fled the invasion to neighboring Algeria, where they settled in refugee camps in the middle of the desert. The Moroccan invasion set off a 16-year-long war with the Sahrawi liberation movement known as the Polisario Front. Morocco's army, with the help of U.S. military aid, drove the Polisario to Western Sahara's eastern desert. Morocco then created the world's longest minefield and built the second longest wall on Earth with the help of U.S. weapons companies Northrop and Westinghouse. The nearly 1,700-mile wall divides Sahrawis who remain under occupation from those who fled into exile. The Moroccan government began decades of torture, disappearances, killings, and repression against pro-independence Sahrawis living in the occupied territory. In 1991, the UN sponsored a ceasefire and promised Sahrawis a referendum on self-determination, organized by its peacekeeping mission known as MINURSO. Since then, Morocco has blocked attempts to organize the vote, and the UN Security Council has refused to implement its own referendum plan or allow MINURSO to monitor the human rights situation in the territory. Today, no country recognizes Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara, one of the most inaccessible places in the world. And the international media has largely ignored the occupation, in part because Morocco has routinely blocked journalists from entering Western Sahara. But in late 2016, Democracy Now! Successfully broke the news blockade. We were in Marrakesh, Morocco, for the United Nations Climate Change Conference. With UN credentials and U.S. passports, we decided to take a chance and attempt to do what no foreign television crew has done in years, report from Africa's last colony. An excerpt from Democracy Now!'s documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. Special thanks to Mike Burke, John Hamilton, Dennis Moynihan, and Laura Gottesdiener. You can watch the full documentary at democracynow.org. On Friday, a nearly three-decade-old ceasefire has ended in occupied Western Sahara after Morocco launched a military operation. We're now joined by Jacob Mundy, Associate Professor of Peace and Conflict Studies and Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at Colgate University. He co-authored the book, Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. Professor Mundy, it's great to have you on Democracy Now! We just went deep dive into the history of what's happening in Western Sahara, Africa's last colony, because so few people understand what's happening there. But this critical moment that took place last week, when Morocco violated the no-buffer zone, explain the significance of breaking this 29-year ceasefire.
Well, yeah, we haven't seen fighting like this in Western Sahara since 1991. There have been periods where, due to increasing tensions and the lack of progress towards self-determination, we've seen tensions on the rise. But to have open warfare like this is very significant. The civilians that were blockading the road, being really the only paved road that connects West Africa to Europe, was a significant tactical victory by Polisario, and it clearly aggravated Morocco enough that they launched a military incursion. And Morocco has said explicitly that this was a military operation. So what we have is Moroccan forces crossing into a restricted area that's technically under Polisario sovereignty. So this is a clear violation of the ceasefire, and we've heard nothing from the Security Council.
So explain what the stakes are right now. And also, what do you understand as U.S. involvement? We saw this tweet from Sahrawi Voice. On the same day the Moroccan army launched its operation in Guerguerat yesterday, which was last week, U.S. Army Major General Andrew Rolling was meeting with Moroccan General Belkhir El Farouk, who's in charge of Morocco's army operations in Western Sahara.
Well, the significance is that if this spirals out of control, you could see a very significant war between Morocco and Polisario forces. Were Morocco to chase Polisario forces all the way into Algeria, then you could see a third party enter, which is Algeria, which is also on high alert right now, and very concerned about this in terms of what it does for security across the Sahara region, which we've seen in recent years has been a zone that's seen a lot of conflict and terrorism and unfortunate things like that. The connections between the Moroccan military and the U.S. military have grown in recent years, largely due to Morocco's cooperation with the construction of AFRICOM as the U.S. military command in Africa. Morocco hosts one of the largest training exercises organized by AFRICOM. It's called the African Lion Annual Exercise, where countries from all over Africa participate. It's usually held provocatively, I think, in southern Morocco, not too far from Western Sahara. So it certainly it's not good optics that Morocco chose to launch this military incursion in violation of the UN ceasefire on the same day that military commanders were in Morocco preparing for the annual African Lion Exercise.
And can you talk about what happened when the United States was pushing for Arab nations to recognize Israel? You know, UAE, among others, Jared Kushner making a massive weapons deal with UAE. And then we heard that Morocco would be one of the countries that would do this as well. Now, in 2019, in the Trump administration, major weapons sales to Morocco. And then we heard that perhaps Morocco would also recognize Israel, perhaps in exchange for U.S. recognizing de facto Morocco's occupation, de facto occupation of annexation of Western Sahara.
Yeah, we've heard this reported in several locations. It hasn't happened yet, thankfully. The State Department has actually, in some ways, been historically, as an institution, one of the more sober voices when it comes to these efforts within various U.S. administrations to push for recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara. We saw this in the W. Bush administration with Elliott Abrams, seeking to get U.S. recognition, and the State Department poured cold water over it. And recently, the State Department has said that this isn't on the table in terms of Morocco recognizing Israel in exchange for U.S. recognition of its sovereignty over Western Sahara. So the bigger picture, though, is that, yes, Morocco is using arms purchases as a way of signaling its allegiance to U.S. interests in the region, not having had good relations with the Trump administration so far, having really bet on Clinton winning the elections in 2016, Morocco has had to find other ways to try to communicate to the White House its interest in strengthening their partnership. And so one of the ways they did this was through massive arm purchases that Morocco in 2019 eclipsed Egypt as the number one arms purchaser for U.S. weaponry. And that's their way of signaling to an administration that's been quite aggressive in terms of pushing U.S. weapons abroad. Morocco has tried to get on that train so as to improve relations with the Trump administration.
In 2019, something like $1 billion the U.S. sold in missiles and other weaponry to Morocco. What do you think it will take for another ceasefire right now, Professor Mundy? What can the United Nations do? One of the leaders of the Sahrawi people, Aminatou Haidar, many of these activists are in El Aaiún. They are essentially virtually under house arrest, being monitored nonstop, has appealed to the UN Security Council. And significantly, South Africa is now on the Security Council that has long been an ally of the Sahrawi people.
Well, it will take a major diplomatic initiative from the UN. The Sahrawis are generally very tired of the empty promises of the Security Council and the UN Secretariat. The previous personal envoy who led the negotiations between Morocco and Polisario left in 2019 and hasn't been replaced in over a year and a half. And that just shows you that the Security Council is willing to let this issue drift and has drifted back into open warfare. So it's difficult to say what it will take to pull Polisario back. The Sahrawis, especially those who lived in exile since 1975, about 180,000 of them in the refugee camps in Tindouf, are incredibly frustrated. They've been frustrated for decades. They almost returned to war in 2001, and hundreds of Sahrawis from the diaspora voluntarily returned to Algeria unprompted to join the fight. So you can imagine what, you know, 20 years later, how many Sahrawis are really willing to go to war. And there's really no reason for them to, you know, respect the words of the UN, because the UN has been on the ground since 1991 promising a referendum and has done nothing to push forward with that.
And when you talk about Tindouf in Algeria, where so many Sahrawis are living in refugee camps for years, now it's from these refugee camps that young men, hundreds of them, are leaving to go to this buffer zone to fight?
Exactly. There's a large youth population in the refugee camps, especially young men. There's not a lot of economic activities, opportunities for them. Military service is required, and the reserves are being called up. Polisario already has advanced placements inside what they call the liberated territories, about a fifth of Western Sahara that's under their control. And they've already mobilized attacks against Moroccan positions along the separation wall inside Western Sahara. More troops are heading to the area to reinforce them and to continue the fight. Morocco is pretending like nothing's happening in its media, and that's not surprising. They apparently were caught very unprepared, and some positions that were easily overrun by Polisario forces.
I wanted to go back to give a little more history to what is happening here, to Democracy Now!'s documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. While we were in Western Sahara in 2016, Moroccan authorities violently broke up an independence protest led by Sahrawi women. This was not unusual. We traveled to meet with the women shortly after the protest ended.
Inside, we find a number of women tending to an activist named Aziza Biza, who's retching and vomiting from her injuries.
Should she go to a hospital?
She can't go to a hospital because they will not admit her, and she's also too scared to go there.
The activists have recorded video of their protests and the subsequent beatings by Moroccan forces on cell phones and camcorders. What our cameras couldn't capture, citizen journalists could. We begin downloading their footage as activist Mina Bali describes what happened.
Because of your presence here, we wanted to have a protest and show you how things are here and how we are treated. It's been about 2 years since any journalists have accessed the territory. We came chanting slogans, making peace signs with our fingers, as usual. And then they intervened against us in the street. They were a large group. They pushed us into a narrow street. They took me, one of them grabbed my hair, and he started beating me. He wounded me here, under my nose. He grabbed my breast and continued beating me against the wall. Aziza was with me, and he struck her in the kidney and hit her head against the wall. And then she fell on the ground at my feet. And Galia Jamani was being dragged there. And Sultana Khaya.
I'm going to go with the women to see their bruises. They're going to show me, and then we'll see what we can show the camera.
We follow Sultana Khaya into a small bedroom. She pulls back her melfa, her traditional Sahrawi robe, and shows me fresh bruises on her leg, both arms, and on her breast.
Sultana, describe what happened to you.
All of us were participating as Sahrawis in the peaceful demonstrations for our right to self-determination. I was trying to gather my sisters for the protest at 5 o'clock, and the whole area was besieged. They were insulting us, beating us, dragging us, and using violence to let us know that we weren't going to be able to protest. They tried to single us out and pushed us into narrow streets where they could beat us without anyone observing. What you saw today is nothing compared to what we've witnessed over and over since 1975. But the news never gets out. As Sahrawi women, we're not backing off until we get our final victory and liberate our homeland. The beatings will not deter us from continuing the fight, and even if we die, it will be a sacrifice so that our sons and future generations can live in the freedom that we've been denied.
So that's an excerpt from our Democracy Now! Documentary. We're going to post the whole thing at democracynow.org, 4 days in Western Sahara, Africa's last colony. Professor Jacob Mundi, as we wrap up here, if you can talk—I mean, the women we talk to, for example, Mina Bali, who had just been beaten very badly. Aminatou Haider was not there, but Mina and Aminatou, they are under house siege right now in Eleun. Elgaya Jimi ran the Human Rights Center. Sultana Khaya had her eye poked out by Moroccan police 10 years before, and she was being beaten once again. Where do you see this resistance going at this time? And could you see this becoming an outright major confrontation? And what chance does the Polisario have when it comes to military competition, as opposed to solving this diplomatically?
Yeah, those are good questions. The concern is, and we're seeing evidence, that Morocco is using this new context as a pretext to crack down on Sahrawi civil society. We're actually at the 10-year anniversary of the events that, in the documentary, you noted that Noam Chomsky called the protests at Gedaim Mizik the first uprising of the Arab uprisings of 2011. We're also at the anniversary of the accords whereby Madrid agreed to hand over Western Sahara to Mauritania and Morocco in 1975. So it's a very strange situation we're in right now with these anniversaries. And the significance is that Sahrawi civil society has been under incredible pressure by Morocco since 2010, since the uprising then, and we haven't seen anything significant in terms of popular manifestations. So the blockade at Guerguerat was one of the most significant acts of civil disobedience we've seen from Sahrawis in about a decade. And it was significant enough to trigger Moroccan military incursion that, in turn, triggered a Polisario response that has now led to war. Now, Polisario, it would be very difficult for them to regain territory inside the occupied Western Sahara, but they can do significant damage to Moroccan forces along the defensive barrier, where most of Morocco's thousands, tens of thousands of troops are positioned. And so what we'll see is whether or not this turns into a war of attrition, or if it's just kind of a tit-for-tat exchange, and then hopefully cooler heads from the UN will come in and make the usual promises. And hopefully out of this we can get something more meaningful in terms of a peace process and something that can actually lead to self-determination.
Well, Jacob Mundi, I want to thank you for being with us, Associate Professor of Peace and Conflict Studies and Middle Eastern Islamic Studies at Colgate University, co-author of the book called Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution.
Yusuf, could you talk about the situation in Palestine, in the West Bank and Gaza, in terms of the COVID pandemic?
Absolutely. You know, obviously, this is a disease. And I know your last guest was on talking about the vaccine, and we all hope that there may be some light at the end of the tunnel here. But this is a virus that has impacted the entire world significantly. On top of the challenges that countries around the world are facing in trying to combat this virus, you know, Palestinians are doing that with the added layer of dealing with military occupation and the discriminatory policies of Israeli apartheid. And with a disease like COVID, which makes, acute cases particularly difficult to treat, even in the most advanced health infrastructure settings, as we've seen here in the United States with, over 230,000 deaths now, Palestinians are at a particular disadvantage when cases especially get to that advanced stage. In the Gaza Strip, for example, they have a very small number of ventilators, very under-equipped and under-resourced ICU units. And so the approach there and elsewhere throughout Palestine has really been to try to aggressively contain this through public health measures and through social distancing. And while there was, I think, some early success, we are seeing now a growing number of cases in Gaza and in the West Bank. And I have to emphasize, again, the difficulty of trying to combat this virus with that added layer of military occupation and discrimination. You know, Palestinians often have to struggle to get the kind of access to health care that most people in Israel and here in the United States take for granted because of the military occupation, because of the denial of freedom of movement and the restrictions and so on. The unfortunate reality is that, you know, most Palestinians are probably unlikely to be able to access the level of care that thankfully, you know, Dr. Arakat was able to access. But the reality of occupation means that, those prospects are very much limited for the average Palestinian. And the military occupation, these policies of discrimination are a added comorbidity that most people around the world will not really be able to fully understand.
Yusuf Munir, I want to thank you for being with us, a Palestinian-American analyst with the Arab Center, Washington, D.C.
Hi, Yumna. How you doing?
Hey, Dave. I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. So Yumna Patel is our Palestine correspondent. She's been based in Bethlehem in the West Bank for the past several years. And we're going to talk to her today to find out what folks in Palestine are thinking about the U.S. election. So like I said, Yumna, you've been based there in Palestine through, oh, and there may be some call to prayer noise in the background because it's that time in Palestine. So just enjoy it. So yeah, you've been based in Palestine there during the entire Trump term. What is different now compared to before Trump took office? Have you seen the effects of some of the policies and changes that he and his administration and Kushner have been pushing? Do you see them there on the ground?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we definitely, you know, of course, see the policy changes on the ground. Those were almost immediate as they started coming, you know, over the years. But specifically in terms of the elections, I mean, I remember that I was here in 2016. So I was here throughout the election cycle and sort of leading up to, you know, Trump's win. And so I've seen, you know, kind of the difference in the approach to the elections that Palestinians have had in 2016 versus now. And there's definitely a difference between how people are reacting to Trump. And I think it's a sentiment that's shared by a lot of people around the world, not just in Palestine, you know, and also in the US as well. I remember during the 2016 elections, a lot of my Palestinian friends and colleagues found Trump amusing and, you know, we're sort of laughing all throughout his campaign and even right up to and after the election. And as you definitely know, that was also the approach that a lot of Americans had, that a lot of people in the US media and a lot of people around the world had, was that people, that Trump was treated as just this, you know, laughing stock because he was so far off from what, you know, people around the world had seen before. Coming into office in the US. And so there was, at the beginning in 2016, there was definitely a sense here that people had of, well, you know, America has wreaked havoc in Palestine and across the Middle East for generations. So America kind of deserves Trump and was getting what's coming. And it doesn't mean that Palestinians haven't sympathized with marginalized communities in the U.S. who have suffered under Trump's administration over the past 4 years. It just means that they think Trump has sort of pulled down the facade of democracy and freedom that America was promoting itself as for so many years. And it actually, you know, Trump's ascent to power essentially exposed Americans to what the rest of the world had been suffering for hundreds of years at the hands of, you know, American imperialism and colonialism. You know, this time around, I think things aren't as lighthearted as they were 4 years ago. Even when discussing Trump leading up to the elections, people aren't really laughing anymore. And again, that's not just here. I think that's everywhere else around the world and even in the US, because Palestinians, like the rest of us, you know, have witnessed just how dangerous Trump has been over the past 4 years, especially to the Palestinian people and to their cause. You know, Trump has consistently denied basic Palestinian rights, like the right to self-determination and sovereignty over their land, the right of return to refugees, et cetera. You know, so Palestinians, many Palestinians have told me that, you know, Trump essentially gave their land to Israel as a gift over the past 4 years. That's, you know, essentially the approach that the Trump administration has taken.
Yeah, yeah. I remember when I was in Palestine in, going back to 2004, and it was fairly common for me to hear people say that they wanted George Bush to win that election against John Kerry because they felt that he was kind of more of an honest broker. But that you're not hearing that about like how they view the Republicans or the conservative right-wing candidate this time. It's really just they don't like the dude.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't think anyone was ever under the impression, even back in 2016, that Trump was going to be an honest broker of, you know, peace in the region. And I guess from when you were here to 4 years ago, enough time had passed where, you know, the Palestinians have or their attitude towards the U.S. have really been solidified through experience and through history, in terms of the fact that, you know, Palestinians at the end of the day know that the U.S. will always be, you know, Israel's strongest ally, and at the end of the day are inclined to tailor their policy towards Israel's interest. It's just that Trump has gone sort of above and beyond that, above and beyond what people expected, you know, in his time in office.
Yeah. I know over the past few days, you've been talking to people on the street about their election. What were some of the specific things that just kind of normal everyday folks mentioned when you asked them about the election?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, there was, it seemed like there was sort of this general consensus or feeling amongst people. I would describe it as kind of like resigned apprehension, you know. You know, people are going to be paying attention to what's happening. But at the same time, a lot of the people that I spoke to, you know, said they're not really expecting much. You know, people were saying that they don't, you know, they would like for Trump to lose, but at the same time, if Biden wins, it's not going to mean this, you know, huge change for Palestinians and this sudden awakening in terms of American foreign policy towards Palestine. You know, people told me that, you know, someone said that Biden might be better for the Americans, but for me as a Palestinian, I don't necessarily think that he's the best choice. And that same person actually expressed that they had wished that Bernie was in Biden's place, because they thought that Bernie could actually offer, you know, a just, you know, solution for a lot of the issues facing Palestinians. But yeah, people said that, you know, they're not really, they're holding their breath. You know, Joe Biden has consistently expressed his staunch support for Israel. And, you know, policy analysts in the U.S. have said that Joe Biden is one, if not, you know, one of the most pro-Israel Democratic candidates that we've had. And Palestinians know that. So at the end of the day, whether it's Trump or Biden, Palestinians are prepared to be at the receiving end of the same pro-Israel U.S. policy, you know, that's dictated their lives for the past few decades, you know, especially since the Oslo Accords were signed. So there's definitely this feeling of, okay, you know, we want to know what's going to happen. It's obviously going to affect our lives, as we've seen over the past 4 years, and it would be great if Trump lost, just because he's been so bad for us and so bad for so many other people. But they don't think that Joe Biden is going to be, you know, some big saving grace for them. They think it's going to be a lot of what they've seen, you know, from the Obama administration and even before that.
Well, and I was going to ask, is there any lingering, or what are the lingering feelings about Obama and his administration and Biden's connection to that?
Yeah, so one of, you know, one of the Palestinian women that I spoke to, she said, you know, Joe Biden was the vice president for Obama, and Palestinians had really high hopes for Obama when, you know, he was elected, because he talked up a big game about, you know, wanting to promote peace and, you know, change all of these things in the region and empower Palestinians, et cetera. But at the end of the day, even, you know, during the Obama presidency, the U.S. continued to give billions of dollars in military funding to Israel. And Obama did very little to change anything for the better for Palestinians on the ground. He more so just maintained the status quo. So Palestinians were very disappointed. You know, I get this feeling, or a lot of people have expressed that Palestinians were very disappointed in the Obama administration and Obama's time in office. And so people mentioned that, you know, well, Joe Biden was Obama's vice president, and he sort of represents the same, you know, establishment Democratic Party that Obama was a part of. So I think that sort of resentment towards the Obama administration and what they failed to do for the Palestinians is definitely carrying over into people and what they think about Joe Biden.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. What about, that's kind of a picture of Palestinians generally. Have you spoken to anybody in the PA, the Palestinian Authority, or local governments that you know? And what are the sort of the political segment or the governmental segment in Palestine thinking about this or looking forward to with Joe Biden or not?
Right. So what I've heard and read and, you know, sort of heard from people that are involved in the Palestinian leadership or people that are sort of more in tune of what's going on there. You know, officials in the Palestinian Authority are definitely hoping and praying for a Biden win with the hopes that a Trump loss, you know, will somehow give them the opportunity to reverse at least some of the devastating effects that the Trump presidency has had on Palestinian society, specifically the Palestinian leadership and the Palestinian Authority. So, you know, an end to the Trump administration would at least give, you know, the Trump administration and all the policies that they've enacted over the past few years have, you know, really backed the PA and the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, into, you know, into a corner. And the Palestinian leadership have, they've played all their cards. They don't have much leverage, you know, over the U.S. and Israel anymore. So they've just been forced to sort of accept whatever policy Netanyahu and Trump declare as, you know, law or fact or whatever. So, you know, I think there's definitely the hope amongst the Palestinian leadership. They would have a chance to reverse some of those policies, specifically in terms of, you know, financial aid and sort of the economic hardships that Palestinians have had to endure because of the Trump administration. So one major point that people have talked about and a lot of the local media as well is reporting on is sort of Abbas's desire to end his protest against Trump and Netanyahu's annexation plan. So basically when Israel announced annexation and that they were going to move forward with it with the full backing of the U.S., in protest, Abbas refused to accept, you know, the tax transfers of hundreds of million dollars in tax revenues that Israel collects on behalf of the Palestinian Authority. So those lack of tax refunds have forced the PA to enforce major salary cuts across the board and to all their civil servants, so government workers, teachers, etc. And those salary cuts have been maintained throughout the pandemic, and that has exerted a lot of sort of pressure on the Palestinian leadership from the citizenry. So there's sort of this idea that, okay, if Biden wins, and Biden has expressed that he does not support annexation and is not going to give the U.S. approval of that. So one point is that, okay, well, if, you know, the U.S. isn't supporting annexation anymore, then we can sort of end this protest in the form of refusing tax revenue so that they'll be able to get that money back and start accepting that money again and pay their civil servants and salaries, et cetera. At the same time, you know, Palestinian leaders are hoping that a Joe Biden presidency will reinstate essential funding for their government and for organizations like USAID and UNRWA, which were stripped of funding under Trump and have left, you know, huge, you know, gaping holes in terms of Palestinian humanitarian relief and the ability of the government to operate. So there are some things. So that's, you know, sort of financially. And I think that's, from what I've heard, that's sort of the most immediate desire of the PA and Palestinian leaders is to sort of reverse all those economic hits that they've taken under the Trump administration. In terms of, you know, diplomatically, there's this feeling that there's not much that the leadership can do to reverse some of the big diplomatic decisions that Trump took. The biggest one, for example, was moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Joe Biden has already said that he's not going to move the embassy back. So that's a huge loss for Palestinians, as you know, that is, you know, that decision is done and it's likely going to stay that way, you know, whether it's Joe Biden and whoever comes after him, it's unlikely that the embassy is going to be moved back. Another would be sort of the reopening of the Palestinian mission to the U.S. in Washington. It definitely remains unclear if that would be reopened under a Biden administration. So I think, you know, diplomatically, there is definitely a hope that at least under a Biden Biden administration would give way to some warming of relations, you know, back between the Palestinian Authority and the U.S. government. And there's the big hope that a Trump loss would mean sacking the deal of the century and Trump's whole plan for the region and the reinstatement of the two-state solution and sort of working within those parameters. Again, that's the Palestinian leadership. That's not necessarily a position shared by all Palestinians. Not that Palestinians support Trump's plan, but a lot of Palestinians, especially young Palestinians, have become very, feel disenfranchised and disoriented with the whole peace process and the two-state solution, and, have expressed that the two-state solution died a long time ago, and the facts on the ground are not conducive towards, moving forward with that plan. But in terms of the PA, I think that they just like to get rid of Trump's plans for the region and at least move back to a time where they had a little bit more control over the negotiating process and sort of how they wanted to move forward.
So that's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
COVID-19 pandemic in Canada is serious. We must continue to practice all public health measures. Follow local guidelines for gatherings, maintain physical distancing, wash your hands, wear a mask, and download the COVID Alert app. If you have symptoms, even mild ones, stay home. Protect yourself and others. Learn more at canada.ca/coronavirus or 1-833-784-4397. A message from the Government of Canada.
Plus que jamais, la santé de tous est entre nos mains. Sur mon cellulaire, l'application Alerte COVID m'avise si j'ai été en contact avec une personne déclarée positive récemment. Du bout des doigts et dans le respect de ma vie privée, je peux protéger ma santé et celle de mes proches simplement en téléchargeant l'application Alerte COVID. Rendez-vous dès maintenant sur québec.ca/alerte-covid pour obtenir plus de renseignements sur l'application et apprendre comment la télécharger. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT is going online for our 2020 annual general meeting. Join us on Monday, November 23rd at 6 p.m. to hear how your favorite community radio station has been adapting to the current pandemic by broadcasting remotely. To find out how you can get involved in one of our various committees, to propose a motion, or find out more information about joining our Board of Governors, email culture@ckut.ca. That's culture@ckut.ca. Monday, November 23rd at 6 p.m. online, CKUT's annual general meeting. To RSVP for the event, email agm@ckut.ca. That's agm@ckut.ca.
the one that people looking up to. Yeah, I tried to reach the sun, but got me stuck to my shoes. Yeah, you got to be the one that people looking up to. Yeah, I tried to reach the sun, but got me stuck to my shoes. I'm only human.
I'm not perfect, just a person.
Yeah, I'm only human.
Sometimes happy, yeah, sometimes nervous.
I'm only human.
I'm not perfect, just a person.
I'm only human.
Sometimes happy, yeah, sometimes nervous.
Game, I ain't been here long, so forgive me if I get this wrong. I get lost sometimes, literally I roam. I had to figure certain things out on my own. Make a phone call home to the ones I love. Shit crazy out here, hey, you high off drugs. To be real, man, I thought about pulling the plug so I can go fly high with the ones above. Yeah, I don't wanna be judged, I just wanna be me. Even though we buy chains, we just wanna be free. I don't wanna be judged, I just wanna be me. We just wanna be free.
You got to be the one that people looking up to.